Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And let's start on this 9/11 with an update from abroad on the war that traces its origins to this date. American troops marked the 8th anniversary of September 11th with a memorial service at the Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan. After the deadliest month in the war so far, 51 Americans killed in Afghanistan in August. Yesterday, top congressional Democrats told President Obama to produce a plan for winning the war or risk their opposition to sending even more U.S. forces there. And there are questions about the will of the coalition of more than 20 countries that have contributed to and lost troops in the war. Nick Childs is the BBC security and defense correspondent in London. Nick, what is the mood in Britain?
Well, I think the mood is very fragile in Britain, probably for a lot of the same reasons that it's fragile in the United States at the moment, including the fact that the British have seen the worst level of casualties since the beginning of the Afghan war. That's certainly brought Afghanistan very much back to centre stage in terms of British public opinion and British concerns. And for that reason, the government is also very concerned about keeping political will on board. There are other issues as well. There is a resources issue, perhaps slightly different from in the United States, not so much whether there is a preparation to commit more troops, but whether the government is providing enough money to give the troops the right amount of equipment and to give the armed forces what they want in terms of extra resources on the ground. So that's put Gordon Brown, the Prime Minister, very much on the political back foot here.
Well, the Spanish government today agreed to send more troops to Afghanistan, but what about the rest of the European part of the coalition, Germany and France, calling for an international conference on Afghanistan? Any sense that the coalition isn't going to hold?
I think we are at a critical moment, frankly, in the whole strategy and support for it for a number of reasons, including public opinion across Europe, and perhaps it is more fragile than in the United States. The broader questions of why the Afghan mission is going on at the moment. Certainly in Britain, it's a very clear-cut message from the government that British troops are on the ground to protect the security of British streets, that's where the terror threat really emanates, is from that part of the world. But there is a worry that people aren't buying it here, or at least they're not listening to that argument at the moment. And I think that's the same in Europe generally. There is confusion about why the West is still in Afghanistan, and there isn't the same attachment to the idea of why Afghanistan matters than I think there is even in Britain, but certainly in the United States.
Well, and in the United States, because of the almost 3,000 people killed on this day 8 years ago, many people here still passionately believing that fighting the war in Afghanistan is fighting in their honor. We're reminded, too, that hundreds of British workers died in the World Trade Towers. How is this day marked there?
People remember it, of course. It's etched on large numbers of people's memories, of course. It is important. It matters for Britain. There isn't the same public response, if you like, that there obviously is in the United States, particularly on the scenes of the attacks. But certainly people are very conscious that things changed then around the world, really. But people are also beginning to question whether it's quite the same issue that it was, and whether actually the right focus exists at the moment, that Afghanistan should be the focus here on in, and whether people should be looking to matters elsewhere in Pakistan, and indeed what the response to 9/11 has meant in terms of, you know, the global struggle that's out there at the moment.
Nick Childs, the BBC's security and defense correspondent in London. Nick, thank you.
Thank you.
That's how fire stations summon volunteer firefighters on New York's Long Island. Some towns like Manhasset, an old suburb, the inspiration for the fictional East Egg in Fitzgerald's Great Gatsby, also sound a siren, a sort of a lunch and dinner whistle at noon and 6 p.m. It always felt like a mournful sound to me, more so after 9/11, knowing that so many firefighters rushed to their death. My mom lived in Manhasset. 50 people from there died in the attack on the World Trade Towers, just 16 miles away. You might remember we went there to see how people were coping. Well, reporter J.R. Moeringer went as well. He met a young man whose father was killed while washing windows at the World Trade Towers. The young man wanted to meet someplace that felt safe. Do you remember where the old Publican's Bar used to be? He asked J.R. Boy, did he ever.
Everyone has a holy place, a refuge, where their heart is purer, their mind clearer, where they feel closer to God or love or truth or whatever it is they happen to worship. For better or worse, my holy place was Publican's, and because I found it in my youth, the bar was that much more sacred, its image clouded by that special reverence children accord those places where they feel safe. Others might feel this way about a classroom or playground, a theater or church, a laboratory or library or stadium, even a home, but none of these places claimed me. We exalt what is at hand. Had I grown up beside a river or an ocean, some natural avenue of self-discovery and escape, I might have mythologized it. Instead, I grew up 142 steps from a glorious old American tavern, and that has made all the difference.
J.R. Moringer grew up in Manhasset, or more accurately, at Publican's. As he writes in his exquisite memoir, Manhasset is known as a bedroom community right there on the Long Island Railroad, but it really is a barroom community, and for years the bar was Publican's. For him, the bar and the men in it became the father he never had. And in reporting on 9/11, he realized there were many more children in his hometown now without fathers and mothers. His book is called The Tender Bar, a Memoir. Today we want to have a conversation with author J.R. Moringer about a town still reverberating from 9/11, but also about the somewhat cautionary tale he tells of a bar that was a refuge from pain. J.R., welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And it's stunning in reading your book that 9/11 is really a postscript. We, soon realize when we get to the end that 9/11 took people we'd just spent hours reading about. Who are some of the people lost from your life story?
Well, there was my cousin, Tim Byrne, who worked for Sandler O'Neill. He was on the 104th floor of one of the towers, and after the first plane hit, he called his mother and said that everything was fine, not to worry, and that was the last we ever heard from him again.
And we meet him in the book as this young stoic cousin who, after his father dies, bears the weight of his coffin and then the weight of the family, all the kids. He was like the pillar of that family.
He was. Too many siblings to count, like so many Catholic families on Long Island. And and he stepped right into the role that his father had played, and a shoulder for his mother to lean on. And so his loss was devastating to them. And also there was one of the bartenders who helped to raise me, Peter Owens.
Peter was a bartender who was so kind but honest with you. You were struggling to be a writer. He says, boy, your writing's not very good.
He was the first editor I ever knew who was able to combine insightful criticism with kindness, and he often did it at 2 o'clock in the morning while serving me a cocktail.
There was an old friend from college?
Yes, a wonderful guy named Dave Beret, who I idolized.
Yeah, this was, you eventually, after a lot of bumps, got into Yale. Mm-hmm. But here you were, the fatherless kid. You didn't think you belonged. And he was the guy you spied across the campus who looked so perfect.
He was the guy who consummately belonged. He was Yale. And to learn that he had died on that day was, it was the third blow. I think that was the third name that I heard.
Well, and there was another. There was the husband of Michelle, one of the girls that got away at Publican's, that you said, I should have married her.
Right.
And then found out that she did marry and her husband died. So many in town. You came back to town to report on this day 8 years ago. Just remind us of some of the images in the aftermath.
Well, the images that stay in my mind are the faces, ashen. I would go into bars either to interview people or visit them, and the bartenders had all just been crying.
Well, and we should say my mom's house and your grandpa's house where you lived were steps from each other, both steps from Publican's, the neighborhood tavern. And I remember someone had rented her driveway so he could park there and then walk to the train station, which was the heartbeat of the town. Mm-hmm. All the commuters went there. He never surfaced for the car. We didn't know his last name. And you reported on cars that were in the train station itself that just never left.
Yeah, it was a common occurrence. One car in particular became iconic for the town because it stayed there the longest, and everyone knew who it belonged to, and it was covered with cards and candles and notes, and it just stayed and stayed, and no one had the heart to do anything about it for the longest time. It was the saddest place I've ever been, and the fact that it was my hometown made me that much sadder about it.
Well, one thing I heard over and over was that people saying a side effect of 9/11 was people going back to drinking. And that brings us back to publicans and your story, which is a complicated one. Manhasset had something of a reputation for its drinking.
It's legendary. I always was told growing up that it was the site of the largest liquor store in New York State, and that it was the only town in New York with a cocktail named after it. Manhasset is said to be a Manhattan, only with a little more alcohol. And Plandome Road, the main thoroughfare of Manhasset, when I was growing up, was just one bar after another. It was like an Irish country lane. You'd meet people in different parts of the country, and they would ask where you were from, and you'd say Manhasset, and they would tell you about 3 days they'd spent drinking there once. And then if you were more literary-minded, you might know that Fitzgerald had once converted it into a fictional playground for the rich.
Well, and those who did drink in the bar of choice, publicans, were very literary-minded. You were the only child of a single mom mm-hmm. who retreated to her parents' sort of falling-apart house, as you write, after your dad beat her and then disappeared. So here you are, a fatherless child. What did publicans mean to you?
Well, if only he had disappeared. That was part of his legacy, is that he was a well-known radio disc jockey right. in New York. So I grew up not knowing who he was or what he looked like, but I knew all too well what he sounded like. His voice was always coming from the radio. And listening to the radio, obsessing about why he wasn't around and trying to create a picture that would go with that voice, I think that set me up to idealize the masculine. And from there, it was a half step to idealizing the nearest men in my life. And they
were 142 steps.
exactly. And they were the men at the bar on the corner. And this bar, it was just a rare assortment of alphas. You had cops and firefighters, of course, but also Wall Street tycoons, titans of finance. You had fugitives and small-time hoodlums. And there was a fair number of models who hung out there, maybe because of the athletes. New York Mets and New York Yankees would drop in.
And the owner, Steve, charismatic mm-hmm. guy, also wanted it to be a family place, so there was a restaurant, and your Uncle Charlie as the main bartender. Tell us a little bit about these men. There was Uncle Charlie, there was Cager, the Vietnam veteran, there mm-hmm. was Bob the cop, who was the harbor policeman.
My Uncle Charlie was the gatekeeper. He was the bartender everybody knew. When I was a very young boy, he opened that gate for me. I wasn't allowed to drink in the bar until I was legal, and that was a big night. The men called it my bar mitzvah, and that was the night they said I became a man.
And you joined these men who drank so much that they, when they went to the beach, the green flies that bit them died from alcohol poisoning. But later, events would sober you up quite a bit. That's J.R. Moeringer. His memoir is The Tender Bar, the story of growing up literally in the town tavern, publicans in Manhasset, Long Island. The book ends with the impact of 9/11 on his hometown. 50 residents, mostly parents, dying at Ground Zero that day. We're going to take a break and have more with J.R. Also later, burning the midnight oil at a community college in Boston. But we'll be back in 1 minute here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation with author J.R. Moeringer. Before 9/11, before everything changed, a patron walked into Publicans, the Manhasset Long Island bar in J.R.'s memoir, The Tender Bar, waving a copy of the book, The Ginger Man, and quoting its first line, "Today, a rare son of spring." And J.R., soon others were quoting Kerouac and Faulkner and Shakespeare, debating the different Batman villains, laying out the solar system on the bar with olives.
And lemons.
And lemons. you kept shoeboxes filled with cocktail napkins on which you'd written down some of the things you heard in the bar.
One line in particular, I remember it was Colt's brother, and he was yelling at a customer. He was saying, "Don't laugh at me." And he said, "The last person who laughed at me was my mother, and I had her operated on needlessly." And I wrote it down on a napkin, and I felt such gratitude to my younger self for leaving that present for me to find.
There was a lot of finger-pointing into your chest from these men, telling you, stick with your attempts to get into Yale, stick with your attempts to try to be a writer at the New York Times.
Well, if there were going to have been a motto inscribed over the door for these men, it would have been do as I say, not as I do.
Well, there you go, because the men in the bar taught you how to be a man, mm-hmm. but they also almost killed you. They
right.
they took you to the beach, which, by the way, reads like the cast of The Sopranos, you know, hitting
yes.
the sand. But they drove drunk. Mm-hmm. They poured alcohol into you. When did you begin to think, I am going to be one of these guys? I am going to be glued to a stool if I don't stop this drinking.
It was when Steve, the owner, died after a night of drinking. We never really did understand how much he'd had to drink, but he went home and he took a fall. And his funeral was one of the, until 9/11, it was the saddest day in the history of Manhasset. I mean, hundreds and hundreds of people descended on the bar to say goodbye. And as moving as that was, it was also scary because it was a night when I just thought that maybe this wasn't the place for me to spend the rest of my life. Maybe we'd all been drinking too much. And his death made me question a lot about my life.
Something about the bar, it seemed, began to seem frozen in amber. There were the mixed drinks from the 30s, you know, Frank Sinatra, A Casual Girlfriend gently links your love of Sinatra to the fact that the only thing your dad left when he left you was his stack of Sinatra albums.
Mm-hmm.
How much of being in the bar did you start to recognize was being in sort of a state of arrested development?
I think at one point an image came to me that we all felt as if we were in a submarine trapped on the ocean floor. And that didn't seem like a very healthy image to me. And I was a copy boy at the New York Times. That wasn't working out. And night after night, I found that I was just leaning against the bar and feeling sad. And when Steve died, I felt a kind of an overpowering urge to do him proud and also to not become like these men, which was a difficult decision because I'd spent most of my life idolizing them. So leaving the bar was one of the most difficult decisions, one of the scariest decisions I ever made. And the next time I went back was September 11, 2001.
Yeah. Do you think these father figures minded that you made that choice?
No, I think they respected it. I think they knew how much I loved them. Not many of them had their own sons, and so maybe I was the closest thing they were ever going to have. But not one of them discouraged me. Not one of them discouraged me seriously. One man, Dalton, who I write about, warned me that in the rest of the country, they have this thing called last call. And he was describing this the way ancient travelers would be warned about, monsters at the edge of the map. You know, he was saying out there beyond the Great Plains, they have this thing called last call. So beware. I'm lucky not only that I left, but that I left when I did. I was drinking too much and I was mimicking alcoholics, but I left before I had any trouble stopping.
And yet, how much poorer is the town that it doesn't have publicans anymore?
Well, that's the difficult thing. Much poorer, and that impoverishment was felt poignantly on 9/11 because there was no place to go. And people said that over and over to me. There's no place to go. There's no place to gather for news, and not the kind of news coming out of the TV, but real news. And there's no place to get that real comfort that we used to get. And that's the difficult thing. That's the contradictory thing about my experience of the bar and my memories of it. I always worried that Steve, the owner, had died for our sins, that he had died so that we might be free, because I do wonder often what my life would be like if it hadn't been for my leaving that bar at 25 years old.
Yeah. So much of what defined you was that you were this fatherless child growing up in this family-oriented town, and then your shock on 9/11, realizing how many, 50 people from this town. Your thoughts about these kids who now have gone 8 years without one or two parents?
Well, the shock wasn't just that it was a town full of fatherless children, but what I heard time and again was that the town had every intention of mitigating the difficulty that those children would face, coming together and being unofficial aunts and uncles to those children. And that's what the town did for me.
By the way, we just want to note that your entire book is about your search for a father, and you ultimately find that father in your mother.
Yes.
Who is an extraordinary woman.
She's definitely the heroine of my memoir. It's the great secret that all these quote-unquote male characteristics that I was finding lacking in myself and seeking in other guys, whether it was courage or determination or perseverance or even a certain swagger, she had them in spades. Never buckled, never wavered, and also saw that even though a bar wasn't the best place for her son to find surrogate fathers, that it was better than nothing. She saw these guys for what they were. She recognized that I was going to have to pull back from them eventually. She trusted her brother, my Uncle Charlie, and these other guys to do their best by me, and they did.
That's J.R. Moringer. His memoir is called The Tender Bar, about growing up in Manhasset. He also went back as a reporter to report on Manhasset post 9/11. The town lost 50 people in the attacks on the World Trade Center. He won the Pulitzer Prize for his feature writing in 2000. J.R., thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you for having me.
Won't you tell her, please, to put on some speed? Follow my lead. Oh, how I need someone to watch over me.
Back after the latest news, here and now. Australian and U.S. researchers are saying this week that adults may need just one dose of the swine flu vaccine rather than the two shots previously thought necessary. Health officials are also reporting what may be the first instance of a strain of the virus that's resistant to Tamiflu. That's one of two medications that can ease swine flu symptoms. The Tamiflu-resistant virus passed between two girls at summer camp in North Carolina. Government agencies and schools have been preparing for what's expected to be a serious wave of the swine flu this fall. But what about businesses? A just-released study shows most of them aren't ready. Dr. Jillian Steelfisher is a research scientist at the Harvard School of Public Health and co-author of the survey. Dr. Steelfisher, let's start with the simple question of people being out sick. Are businesses prepared if workers have to stay out, say, 2 weeks, which people may have to do for the swine flu?
I think that's really where we look at some vulnerabilities on the part of businesses. So our study suggests that about a third of businesses say they could survive without any major operational problems for 2 weeks if about half their workforce was absent. So that's a real potential problem.
Yeah.
And even if we're talking about an absenteeism of about 30%, only about half of businesses told us that they could make it 2 weeks without significant problems in their operations.
Well, this becomes an even bigger problem because there are categories of business that the Department of Homeland Security has said are critical to the country. Food, for instance, food production. Were those businesses more prepared than average businesses?
Well, unfortunately, we didn't see any differences between those industries labeled key resources and industries that were not. So these vulnerabilities are widespread.
Well, and then it goes a little deeper because it's one thing to have someone out sick. Businesses also didn't seem to be prepared for family members who may have to stay home and take care of someone. You reported that only a third offered leave for workers who needed to take care of sick family members.
Absolutely. And that's a real problem if the flu requires people to stay home to take care of their family.
Right.
If schools or daycares are closed, we see an even greater problem. Only about 20% of businesses offer support for that in a paid leave form.
Well, and some ask for a doctor's note before granting sick leave or any kind of leave. What's the problem there?
Well, I think in the context of a widespread outbreak, businesses want to keep people home so they don't infect coworkers at the workplace. But about half of businesses that offer sick leave require a doctor's note to take that leave. So it's something for businesses to think about and to create partnerships with their employees during an outbreak like this.
Well, what else would you advise businesses to do, having made the study? The Centers for Disease Control is using the information you've gathered. So what would you advise?
The time to think about this is now. So planning for an emergency in the crisis of an emergency is not as effective as thinking about it now and beginning to develop a partnership with your employees. So they may need to come up with their own customized strategies.
Ways to have temporary workers in the back of your mind, ways to have people work at home.
All of these strategies that might help businesses deal with a sustained absenteeism in their operations.
Dr. Steelfisher, do you see businesses, you know, handing out rubber gloves and face masks? I mean, how else do you see that? We are told that the fall wave of the flu could be much more serious than what we saw in the spring. So what are some other things you know, in trying to imagine outside of the box, you think businesses might do?
So if the outbreak becomes more severe, businesses may begin to consider strategies that will help put distance between employees at the worksite and between employees and their customers. So one strategy that may be considered is staggering shifts, both to put distance between employees at the worksite and on mass transit. So these are strategies that they may want to think about, and again, they would be probably recommended in the context of a much more severe outbreak, but in terms of emergency planning, it may be something to at least have as a thought in your mind at this point.
That's Dr. Julian Steelfisher, a research scientist at the Harvard School of Public Health, co-author of their recent study on how businesses are prepared for swine flu. Dr. Steelfisher, thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Okay, just a quick reminder, you can always listen to our program stream live at our website, hereandnow.org, where you can also download a podcast. That's hereandnow.org. Just ahead, remember when we told you a community college was starting classes at midnight? They have in 30 seconds, here and now. Enrollment at community colleges across the country is up an average of 20% as people try to make themselves more marketable in the down economy. Last month, we reported that Bunker Hill Community College here in Boston would soon offer midnight classes to meet the growing demand. Well, class is now in session, and here now's Bianca Vasquez-Tonis stayed up late to check it out.
The time is 11:47, please. And print and sign your name.
Hector Gonzalez is late for the 11:45 class, but he stops in the lobby for coffee. He'll need it to get through the almost three-hour lecture.
Basically, that was the only class in psychology that was open.
Gonzalez is a police officer in Chelsea. He works at 7 a.m. 7 a.m. But he needs Psychology 101 for his criminal justice degree.
I prefer to take it in person than web classes. I'd rather have a teacher.
When you think of psychology, what do you think of? Just name words or whatever. The brain? Good.
Professor Kathleen O'Neill came up with the idea of these midnight sessions.
You know, the classes are so packed in the day, and there's so many students that want to come here that maybe it would make sense to run it overnight, because there's students who are up all night. Having teenagers myself, I know they're very much up at midnight. So I thought, you know, why not just open it at night and see what happens?
29 people signed up for the class. That's almost the limit. On the first night, 20 people showed up. Edwin Diaz rolled in late. The 20-year-old works at Logan Airport. He takes bags off planes. His shift starts at 3 a.m.
So basically, the schedule does me good. I get up at 11:30, head over here. And then from there, I just go straight to work.
After work, he'll come back to Bunker Hill Community College.
It's kind of hard, but I got to do it, you know. I ain't trying to work for no minimum wage job for trying to make a career. The more schooling you got, the more money you get. And that's what I'm looking for right now.
It's break time, and Tanique Burns is working her way through a huge glass of iced coffee. The mother of five draws blood for the Red Cross, but she wants to become a nurse.
I have family responsibilities such as sporting events that night classes aren't necessarily conducive to, and I work crazy hours during the day. I don't work at this time of day, so it made sense.
Burns is also signed up for the other midnight class, college writing. Professor Wick Sloan is teaching that class. He came out tonight to bring cookies for moral support.
I think the tragedy in this country now is that there are so many motivated people and so little funding for them to go to college that, to me, this is a cry for help by all of them. That's the reason to teach the class.
If these first two classes are successful, Bunker Hill Community College may hold more midnight classes next semester.
That's Here and Now's Bianca Vasquez-Tonis. Well, let's get some of your thoughts in. Megan Keene, a grad student at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, wrote after the BBC's Lucy Williamson described the response in Britain to the first death of a female British soldier in Afghanistan. Megan writes, "I was very offended that the reaction was said to be strong because she was female, but also blonde, very pretty, very feminine. What does that matter? Every human life has value." We also spoke recently about the large number of wild pythons living in the Florida Everglades and heard from Jan, a python owner, who thanked us for not demonizing them. She writes, "The Everglades pythons have killed nobody, but most media accounts would have us believe they're out to eat our children by the hundred any minute now." Well, quick note, no one has been killed by wild pythons, but New Yorker reporter Burkhard Bilger wanted us to stress that biologists and park officials he spoke with felt they do have a potential problem on their hands. We also have a doozy of a correction. We said that Tchaikovsky's 1812 overture was written to commemorate the defeat of Napoleon by the Brits. Well, what would Tchaikovsky have been doing at Waterloo in Belgium in 1815? Listener Peter Yegorov reminds us the piece was actually written to commemorate how Russians outsmarted Napoleon when he invaded Moscow in 1812. Our piece on Gertrude Ederle, the first woman to swim across the English Channel in 1926, especially resonated for 31-year-old Elaine Howley of Waltham, Massachusetts, who crossed the Channel last month. We called her up, and Elaine, you say you identified with Trudy Ederle's struggle because 8 hours into your 13-and-a-half-hour swim, you also almost didn't make it. What happened?
I started to feel a little seasick, and that was the first time I'd had that problem in one of these long swims. I've done several of them.
Well, you not only have done several of them, you are one of only 33 people to achieve the Triple Crown of open water swimming. Besides the English Channel, what else did you do?
I swam the Catalina Channel and the Around Manhattan Island swim.
Astonishing. What's that like to be out in the English Channel?
It was incredible. It was cold and tough, and there were times when, you know, it was just me inside my own head and trying to get to the other side. But I also had a great support crew who was with me the whole way, and my husband and my friend Krista were keeping me going.
What are your thoughts on Gertrude Ederle? She's out by herself, you know, flailing about. Your thoughts on her?
She was just incredible and is a hero of mine, and her efforts and Florence Chadwick and some of the other pioneers of the sport really have been an inspiration for me. And, you know, I wouldn't be able to do what I'm doing now if it hadn't been for them. And they're, you know, flailing across alone like that, at, you know, drinking beef tea and whatnot to get to the other side. It just would not be a sport for me if they hadn't done that.
But what's next? What's left?
Well, that's a real good question, and right now it totally depends on whether or not I'm able to find some sponsorship. I'd like to do the North Channel next, but...
What's that, the North Channel?
It's between Scotland and Ireland, and it's probably one of the toughest out there. I mean, the English Channel, obviously, is pretty tough, but the North Channel's a few degrees colder, and there's jellyfish the size of trash can lids floating around. So it's pretty intense, but no American's done that one before. So that one I'm kind of, you know, hesitant to throw my hat in the ring on that, but, you know, that is one that I'm considering.
And by the way, we know your channel swim you did to raise money for the Leukemia Society, your sister taken by that disease in 1984.
That's right, yes.
Well, good luck to you in future swims.
Well, thank you very much.
And finally, many of you appreciated our coverage of the death of Senator Ted Kennedy. Dan Bianco of New York City had this response. I'd like to introduce another emotion in the public response to Ted Kennedy's death. Shame. I grew up in New York, a rabid listener to Howard Stern's frequent satirical Kennedy shtick, and in a mostly conservative family, and for most of my life, Mr. Kennedy was defined by Chappaquiddick. It's really not until today, listening to the stories on your program, that I'm starting to realize my neglect in developing a mature view of Senator Kennedy, and that is the source of my shame. As always, we'd love to hear your thoughts. Go to hereandnow.org and click on Contact Us to send an email, or leave a comment right there. We'll be back in a minute, Here and Now. Welcome back. You may have heard Lori Moore is back with a new book. No less than 3 articles in the New York Times have heralded the return of the author of Birds of America after a 12-year absence, using words like haunting and memorable. One reviewer said, "I want to turn to the person nearest me and shout, 'You must read this book.'" We would only add that in reading Lori Moore's new novel, A Gate at the Stairs, we also wanted to shout at the characters, "Look out, pay attention." At the center is 20-year-old Tassie Kilchin, who leaves the family potato farm for a big Midwestern college.
I had come from Delacrosse Central High, from a small farm on the Perryville Road, to this university town of Troy, the Athens of the Midwest. as if from a cave, like the priest child of a Colombian tribe I'd read about in cultural anthropology, a boy made mystical by being kept in the dark for the bulk of his childhood and allowed only stories, no experience of the outside world. Once brought out into light, he would be in a perpetual holy condition of bedazzlement and wonder. No story would ever have been equal to the thing itself, and so it was with me. Nothing had really prepared me. Not the college piggy bank in the dining room, the savings bonds from my grandparents, or the used set of World Book encyclopedias with their beautiful colored charts of international wheat production and photographs of presidential birthplaces. The flat green world of my parents' hogless, horseless farm, its dullness, its flies, its quiet ripped open daily by the fumes and whining of machinery, twisted away and left me with a brilliant city life of books and films and witty friends. Someone had turned on the lights. Someone had led me out of the cave of Perryville Road.
In addition to learning about Chaucer, Sylvia Plath, Sufism, Tassie gets a job as a nanny, taking care of a soon-to-be-adopted biracial child she grows to love but must leave. Lori Moore also has an adopted biracial child, and she teaches English at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, but she says the book isn't autobiographical, so what is it about? Lori joins us from Wisconsin Public Radio with more. Welcome.
Hi, Robin.
And an odd question to start. When in your writing did you know this was such a good story?
Oh, one never knows. One never knows. I mean, there's several stories in the novel. I mean, most novels have several sort of overlapping stories.
Yeah. Well, and we haven't even mentioned one. And that's partly because I'm embarrassed to say I forgot about it as I was reading. And that's the 9/11 connection.
Well, the novel takes place between 9/11 and the invasion of Iraq. So there's this sort of quiet but ominous period.
Well, and you give us a couple of signposts along the way, but as I admitted, I forgot it. And it feels as if some of the characters did as well, or at least they weren't paying as much attention, especially maybe out in the Midwest, away from Ground Zero, busy, trying to have careers and children, as players off stage are going to war.
Well, yeah, in a way. In the Midwest after 9/11, there was recruitment of kids from high schools. I mean, I'm sure this happened in the rest of the country as well. But as the country was sort of gearing up for this invasion, you know, things started to happen. And, you know, people were being, you know, lifted up and taken off. And the novel ends with the student protests that began of this particular foreign policy moment.
Well, in between, Tassie is maybe a lot like me reading it. She's not really paying much attention to the drumbeat. She's going to college.
Well, she is a sort of typical girl who comes to college and finds everything sort of awesome and sophisticated and intellectually stimulating. She's thinking a lot about what does it all mean. Nobody's smarter than people in their 20s. I teach them here, so I know that they're smart. So the challenge for me was to try to, at my age, to try to be as smart as someone in their 20s and try to sort of latch on to things they might be thinking about.
Well, and you nail Tassie's struggles to try to understand her new employer, a glamorous owner of a gourmet restaurant in this fictional college town, you know, juggling, adopting a child with work. She's like an alien to Tassie, whose own mom is an eccentric farmer's wife who puts mirrors in her garden to make it look like there are more flowers.
I think there's a parallel between Tassie's mother, who she also desires to you know, kind of run away from and separate herself from, and Sarah. And that connection is made early on when Tassie realizes that the woman she's babysitting for is the same age as her mother. And so in my mind, I had them sort of be similar women with different wigs on and different outfits and different glasses and different styles of speech, but in my mind they were sort of played by the same actress. They were the mother characters in this novel.
Huh.
I think this is about people struggling to do the right thing and finding their own limitations And of course, some of these characters have greater limitations than others.
Yeah. There's also the trademark Lori Moore hilarity. I was reminded, I was browsing around online and someone mentioned a line you used in an earlier, one of your short stories. The character says, "I was having a dream about you and suddenly I woke up with a jerk and felt very uneasy." And the reply, "Yeah, I hate to wake up with jerks." There's that kind of, I mean, Tassie, her roommate gives her as a gift a sexual toy, which Tassie absentmindedly uses to stir her chocolate milk.
Well, that's just in the world. I don't really feel that I'm using it. I feel like I'm unearthing it and discovering it and collecting it.
And it rubs up against some terrible sadness. The title of Lori Moore's book, A Gate at the Stairs, baby gates were all over the house where Tassie's the nanny. It also looks like, on the cover, a stair rising to heaven.
A gate at the stairs is a barrier to ascension. It's also a kind of protective device. When Tassie goes to interview, she sees that the gate at the stairs that she goes down is broken. And it's a clue to her that, I don't know, it's just a warning. It's like an omen. This book is not for everybody. No novel is for everyone. And I've heard from those people, too. So
saying what? Saying what?
That is too... You know, that it's too dark. It's just too dark. But I understand that.
And part of that darkness involves children. And you go there. I thought that as I read it, how hard it must have... It's hard to read. How hard must it have been to live with that for a while?
Well, it was very hard to write some of the scenes, and I felt that perhaps I was avoiding them, and that's what took so long to complete the book. Yeah, things happening to children, that's a kind of standby in literature, and because it's the thing, you know, adults most fear, something, you know, happening to young people. And of course, when you have a wartime situation, it's all young people who are paying the price for that. And so I wanted all of that to sort of go in, like all the things you most dread and all the things that shouldn't happen, I decided I would make happen. So.
The things we weren't paying attention to. Lori right. Moore, yeah. Lori Moore, A Gate at the Stairs. Thank you so much for speaking with us about it.
Oh, thank you, Robin.